The Ikar and Kokai Report, episode number 49.
Welcome to the Ikar and Kokai Report, the podcast dedicated to making sense of healthcare, from policy to economics, from evidence-based medicine to ethics. Join us as Drs. Michelle Ikar and Anish Kokai diagnose and treat the latest epidemic of healthcare absurdities.
All right. Well, welcome to this latest episode of the Ikar and Kokai Report. Today, we have the pleasure of having Lee Gross on. Dr. Gross is originally from Cleveland, Ohio. He graduated from the Ohio State University and Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. He spent many years in private practice in Florida. And finally, after having an epiphany about affordable healthcare, he started one of the pioneer direct primary care practices in the nation. Called Epiphany Care. He has been a long advocate of direct primary care. He serves as president of the Docs for Care Foundation, which is a national health policy think tank of practicing physicians committed to the establishment of an American healthcare economy which preserves the sanctity of the physician-patient relationship. He, as mentioned before, is a pioneer in the direct primary care delivery model, and he speaks frequently and has recently spoken in Washington, D.C. as well. So welcome, Dr. Gross. Thanks so much for taking the time to come and chat with us.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks so much. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me a little bit about how you had this epiphany. It seems like, in my lifetime, forever ago, in 2010, I was starting my cardiology fellowships. I had no idea about direct primary care or affordable care or anything. So how did you, what was the epiphany and how did you start this path that you're on?
So I've been in practice since 2002. I'm a family physician by training. And, we're on the hamster wheel just like everybody else. And we were playing this game of how we keep our practice afloat. It felt like we were playing a game of whack-a-mole with Medicare, and every time we found a way to generate some revenue for the practice, Medicare would change the rules, and we couldn't get paid for it. And we kept running around, and we ended up implementing electronic health records because they were fantastic for our office and our efficiencies, improved our workflows. But then the government got into the electronic health records and sort of ruined those for us, we kept saying, there has to be a better way to do this. There has to be a simpler way. It just seemed crazy to do what we were doing. And that's when we had our epiphany. Back in 2009 is when we had the epiphany. And we had an employer come to us, a small heating and air conditioning business, and said, doc, all of my employees see you as their doctor and my insurance premiums keep going skyrocketing. Why am I paying an insurance company to pay you? Because you're already their doctor. Why don't I just hire you to take care of the employees? I'll take out a catastrophic policy on them. And even if I pay their deductibles for them, we're likely still going to come out ahead. And, sort of the light went off and said, why are we insuring primary care? Why are we inserting so many barriers between the doctor and the patient? Why is somebody paying somebody else to pay me and then taking a cut of that? That made zero sense. And then that person that was controlling the check was determining what services we could provide to the patients. It made us start to think, what do we need to do to operate outside of the third party payer system? So we reached out to mom and pop pharmacies, we reached out to mom and pop labs and imaging centers and said, what do we need to do our jobs effectively without an insurance company? So I reached out to one of the labs and said, if I were to collect the money up front when I ordered a lab for my patients. And instead of you trying to collect for 6 months, you have to worry about the coding and whether it was a physical or anything else. What if you just sent me one bill for all my patients and all the money was pre-collected from them? And we were able to buy our labs wholesale. We'd see 95% discounts on our labs. And same thing for imaging services, where we would contact the imaging center and say, if you own your CT scanner and your scanner is not running 24 hours a day, much like Priceline.com does for hotel rooms, what could you sell us an unused CAT scan for? What could you sell us an unused MRI for? And we were seeing again, pennies on the dollar. Our CT scans, $175. Our MRI is $225. And so what we decided to do at that point was create a membership-based primary care program. So at the time, we charged $60 a month for adults, $25 for one child, and $10 for each additional child. After that, all the services that we could provide in our office are included at no additional fee, no copays, no deductibles, and we became an insurance-free practice. So it has been eye-opening and a completely life-changing experience for us ever since then.
Yeah, that sounds great. And the interesting thing is, you know, you arrived at this place not because you had some, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you tell me, but not because you had some type of overriding ideology. It's not like you were born a libertarian that was reading Friedrich Hayek or Adam Smith or something, right? You were kind of a doctor that was in the trenches trying to make things work for you and your patients. And it's just the current system wasn't working. So you you naturally progressed to this place that you're at. Would that be accurate?
I think that's perfectly accurate. And as it's evolved, I think, you know, the one thing that's become obvious is that Washington, you know, the more we kept going back to Washington, the solution didn't lie in Washington. It seemed obvious after going back there that the problem lied in Washington. And it became very clear that the cavalry was not coming to save us in healthcare. And so, you know, what we basically evolved to is a position in our practice where we said, you know what, we're not going to ask for permission to take care of our patients anymore. We're not going to ask for help. We're not going to ask for them to fix it. What we're going to do is we're just going to go ahead and fix it. Right. We're going to fix it ourselves. We're going to take it upon ourselves to do this better. And then we're just going to show them what we did.
Yeah, oh, that's great. Are you still primarily working through employers, meaning so the employers essentially come to you and sign up their employees to you, or is it now the case that, you know, patients just find you and sign up for your services?
The vast majority of patients that are members in our practice are individuals.
Okay.
It wasn't until recently that we did just sign up a large employer contract. We just got a contract to take care of a hospital, all their employees and their employees' family members. So they actually restructured their entire employee benefits package around our practice model. And looking forward to sharing a little bit of some of the savings that we're actually going to be able to do with this hospital as an employer. But mostly, I'd say probably 50% of our patients are uninsured. They come to us from all over the state of Florida. So I'm in Southwest Florida in Sarasota County on the Gulf Coast, and I see patients from Miami. I see patients from Orlando. I see patients from hours away. And I've even actually seen patients coming to us from the Caribbean. They come from out of the country to access the care because, you know, not only can they afford what we're doing, but the sort of, I hate to use the word network, but the support structure of price transparency and of the ancillary services that we put together is something that people are willing to travel across the country for. So a CAT scan in New Jersey may cost $3,000 because there are no independent options available. It's only hospital-owned facilities. So it's cheaper for them to get on a plane, travel across the country, fly into the Punta Gorda Airport, see us, get their CAT scan, fly home, have a nice dinner overlooking the Gulf of Mexico, and they're probably still going to pocket $2,000.
To get into some specifics in terms of how much this is all costing, I read a recent article that you wrote in the Washington Examiner that the hardest working man in podcasting, Dr. Akkad, who is joining us, will attach to the show notes. But it looks like you charge about $65 per month for an adult membership, $25 for a child, $10 for each additional child. And that's very close to what it was when you started. Is that correct? 9 years ago?
That is correct. Yeah, we have not seen almost zero cost inflation. You know, so even though we've pretty much kept our fees flat, we've also seen the prices that we have for labs and imaging. Those haven't changed either. in almost 10 years, we have not seen increases in the x-rays, the blood work, or anything that we've done. So almost zero. So whereas the insurance plans are seeing a 15 to 30% year-over-year price increase. You know, and I think that was one of the eye-opening things for me is that, you know, when I was in insurance-based practice, at this almost with the same week, I would get a letter from Blue Cross telling us they're decreasing our payments by 10%. I would get a letter saying that our insurance premiums are going up, you know, 20%. You know, because we had them as our insurance company.
I love it. I love it. The myth of accelerating, never-ending upward healthcare costs. Right.
Right.
Yeah. You're kind of showing that's not entirely accurate or a fair picture at all. Now, just for folks that don't know, we are what you cover for that price again: $65 a month for an adult membership, $25 for a child per month. You cover physical exams, EKG testing, strep and urine testing. You even monitor, you know, you have new tests for blood thinner, people that are on Coumadin, monitoring those things. Surgical procedures like sutures, joint injections. And that's a fairly comprehensive amount of stuff that you're covering. And that's all inclusive. There are no copays or anything at all, correct?
That is exactly correct, yes. Everything that we can do within our office, there's no charge for it. And if it needs to go outside of our office, and we've negotiated wholesale pricing, and we pass along those prices directly to the patient. So, you know, if I need to send off a culture, then there's a $30 charge for the pathologist to do the culture.
I see. Great. And do you pass that on to the, and that gets passed on to the patient, that $35 charge for the pathologist, or?
Exactly. So there's no markup on our side. Blood work, you know, just to kind of give you an example, we can get full blood work for a diabetic patient, probably needs to have this blood work done 3-4 times a year. It's about $45. So that includes comprehensive metabolic panel, cholesterol profile, thyroid testing, complete blood count, you know, hemoglobin A1C to manage a diabetic patient. All that's, you know, again, under $45 for each blood draw.
So now what happens when you have patients that have, you know, more complex needs? So the knock on direct primary care is that, oh, it works great for folks that are healthy, and, you know, do healthy people need to pay $65 a month, et cetera. But, you know, a lot of people will say that, well, what if I have prostate cancer? What if I'm diagnosed with breast cancer? Now, suddenly, what is my DPC doctor going to be able to do for me?
Right. So that's the myth. You know, the myth is that we cherry pick the healthy and leave the sick for the insurance companies, leave the sick for the, you know, for the government to take care of or for Medicaid. And, you know, to your point, the healthy person doesn't want to pay $60 a month. There's no reason for them to pay $60 a month. And so they generally don't see the need, and they are not the ones that are signing up for the practice. It's the people who have chronic medical conditions that are, in fact, signing up for the practice. So we are caring for the chronically sick. We're just not using an insurance product to do so. But, you know, it is always the what ifs.
Right.
And that's frankly what insurance should be for. You know, the what ifs of if your house burns down, that's why you have homeowners insurance. Or the what right. if, you know, if your car gets stolen. It's not the what if you need to replace your windshield wipers.
Right.
So we let the insurance be the insurance, and that's the whole point of that. But, you know, one of the things I think we've discovered is that in many cases, when you start to see what these things cost and what you're actually paying for insurance, the math doesn't work out. So for example, we had a patient that came to us from out of the country with thyroid cancer, and she needed a thyroidectomy. And so she needed a thyroid removal surgery, and it was going to cost her $100,000 to have that surgery done in San Juan. And she lived in Antigua in the Caribbean. And she contacted the Surgery Center of Oklahoma, which is a cash-based surgery center that puts all their prices online, and Dr. Keith Smith, a good friend of mine. And he said, yeah, we can do this surgery, but we need 6 months of preoperative and postoperative medical management. We need imaging services, an endocrine consult, probably some medication management. And so he contacted me and said, you know, hey, Lee, Florida is a heck of a lot closer to the Caribbean than Oklahoma City. Would you mind co-managing this case with us? And so we agreed to do it. Patient got a medical visa, came to the United States, came to our practice. We co-managed it. The entire process, including the surgery and everything, 6 months of medical care was $10,000. So if you look at that once in a lifetime catastrophic event, which can be cured for $10,000, then, you know, if you look at the average insurance premiums now, the average insurance premiums for a family of four is $29,000. And these deductibles are $7,000, $8,000. And so almost the entire cost comes out of pocket.
Right, right. What? So so if you need an oncologist, you need chemotherapy, just walk me through a little bit in terms of how are you doing? How have you, I guess you've created a network where you're able to get even stuff like that for relatively, at a price that's much lower? Or do you at that point have to access, you know, catastrophic insurance type of numbers and, you know, the patient has to, you know, it covers their deductible. This is the part where you use your deductible. Is that how this is working for folks who aren't living in Antigua or whatnot?
Yeah. So if the patient has insurance, then obviously we're using their insurance plans for something like that. We're
right.
Working within their networks. If the patient does not have insurance, in most cases that I've interacted with, Medicaid usually kicks in. So the patient, you know, let's just say they get diagnosed with breast cancer. In almost every situation, the patient that I've had that's been diagnosed with breast cancer that has no insurance usually retroactively qualifies for Medicaid, and Medicaid then covers the patient's treatment. In some situations, we go to charitable foundations and get charity care for these patients. And in some situations, we do rely on. On charity.
Right. So Michelle, there seems to be some need for, there's going to be some need for third party payment, even to fill the gap between, say, what we think of as truly catastrophic and not, right? Because one of the problems is that the landscape is such that we don't have a lot of providers that can necessarily do what Dr. Gross is doing, right? I had a patient an elderly gentleman who was having recurrent syncope, and it turns out he ended up with a pacemaker, and that didn't solve his problem. But the pacemaker, we found out by interrogating the pacemaker that he was having atrial flutter at really rapid rates, and it timed out exactly with every time he would have these syncopal events that were really debilitating. And so, after discovering it, I sent him to a local EP doctor at a local hospital owned by one of the large healthcare systems in the area. And he stayed for 23 hours. He got an atrial flutter ablation, stayed for 23 hours, came in one day, left the next morning. And the bill that was generated was $197,000 for a 23-hour stay. Now, we know everyone says, oh, those numbers are meaningless. They're huge. It doesn't matter what they charge you. What matters is what they pay. Medicare paid $19,000. The patient paid $400. So 23 hours in the hospital for an atrial flutter ablation is $19,000. And the problem here is that, it's the system has made everyone poor. Dr. Smith, when we had him on, said that, is that the system has made everyone poor because of the charges of the prices that are being charged here. And the problem is I don't have, in a local area, I don't know who I could send, to some surgery center of Oklahoma place nearby who could do this atrial flutter ablation for, say, $2,000. So unfortunately, it's kind of like a catch-22. You kind of, until you have more folks like you in various different places, electrophysiology, oncology, or whatever, plastic surgery, et cetera. Well, plastic surgery isn't a good example. There's a lot of cash pay folks there. But, in these other areas, you kind of almost need third-party payment. So, how Michelle, are we going to kind of break this impasse?
Well, perhaps we'll get to it in a moment, but I want to ask Lee a couple more questions about the DPC model. Lee, to what extent do you view the membership model as being essential to the direct care movement, at least in primary care? Or do you think it's, it can work for some physicians and other physicians can choose to do a fee-for-service thing? How do you view that?
Well, I've obviously lived in both worlds. I've lived in a fee-for-service world and I've lived in a membership world. And I can tell you that at this moment, we don't even offer a fee-for-service option. It's what I've seen is that it creates an obstacle for patients to access services, at least on a primary care level. I'm speaking as a primary care physician now. Patients tend to put things off if there's a financial barrier in place, and so they won't access the doctor in a timely manner. They won't access the primary care physician in a timely manner. They'll let things go and fester, or they won't manage their diabetes effectively if there's $175 office visits for each and every visit. Or when they come in, they're going to try to pack so much into one visit that you really can't accomplish anything in that visit. And so the membership really allows us to do a few things. Number one, it allows us to take advantage of technology and use technology visits because you don't need to bring everybody into the office to get paid. It allows us to do things over the telephone or email or internet or texting that you otherwise would have had to bring into the office. And then it allows us to use the office-based visit for truly things that need to be done in the office. So it allows you to take care of the right patient in the right setting at the right time. So that is what membership has allowed for us. As a specialist, particularly a procedural-based specialist, I would think that the membership may not be an appropriate option. I would think a cash-based fee-for-service probably would be perfectly appropriate. It really depends on the specialist. So.
Right. No, I think I agree with you that for primary care, there are many practical reasons why a membership-based model makes sense. And it's one I have adopted for my, I have both a primary care practice and a cardiology practice. And the primary care is on a membership DPC model. But then my next question is, what this membership model also facilitates, and I'd like your opinion on that, is pitching the DPC model to employers and small businesses. And I know some DPC physicians choose to do that and others don't or choose not to. And are there any pitfalls or what do you see happening with that idea of going to a small business that may have 20, 25 employees and saying, listen, we can offer for your employees these primary care services? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the person that gets this right for the small business will revolutionize healthcare delivery in the United States. I think the under 50 employees, if you can figure out a way to get that relationship right, I think that's most of healthcare delivery in the country. That's most of the employees in the country. And so having said that, I'm not sure anyone's really nailed that just yet.
Walk us through the potential problems.
Well, the potential problem is it's another third-party payer.
Right, right, exactly.
You're getting yourself into another third-party payment situation, and so you can get yourself into a situation basically where you're the company doctor, that people don't feel comfortable sharing things for you or sharing things with you because you're the company doc. Mm-hmm. So there are certainly some caveats to doing that. We did just recently enter into an arrangement I was mentioning earlier with a hospital. And so the hospital has restructured their employee benefits package specifically around our practice. And the hospital has said, if you sign up for this practice, they will pay 100% of the DPC membership fee. And they like the DPC part so much, they wanted to steer patients towards it, that they actually reduced their premiums by 20% if they signed up for our practice. So, not only was it free to the employee, but it was cheaper for the employee to come to see us. So from the employee's perspective, no copays, no deductibles. Primary care basically was free to them. And oh, by the way, I get a 20% discount on my insurance premiums if I do that. Stipulation in order to make that arrangement was we had to make the pitch directly to the employees. They had to hire us. We had to speak in front of every employee, and they had to pick us. This was not just, they could assign any doc they wanted to. They really had to choose their primary care doctor. We wanted to be in a situation where we could be hired and fired by the patient, by the hospital. And so that, I think, is the key to is empowering the employee to be the one making the decision. if the employer's the one making the decision, then you're making your practice decisions and you're based upon what's best for the employer's bottom line. And I don't think that works. The incentives aren't properly aligned.
Right. I think that's critically important. And I suspect it'll become easier if there are more, if you have competition, if you as a DPC doctor, you know, if the employees have, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 DPC doctors to choose from, then it makes it easier, perhaps at that point, for the employer to say, listen, we'll reimburse your DPC fee, but you go ahead and select the DPC doctor and that sort of thing. But it is right. Difficult. You're right. It is difficult. It introduces third parties, and it's the patients may not have skin in the game the same way they would otherwise. And so, so that's a potentially difficult, but another option that you're pursuing very actively, and I think perhaps Anish mentioned it in the introduction, is you're trying to make the law more sympathetic to DPC so that it's easier for DPC doctors or for doctors who are not currently adopting the DPC model to get into it. Tell us about what you're doing there.
Yeah, so, you know, as you know, many decades of healthcare delivery, this pendulum keeps swinging back and forth in terms of physician acquisition and consolidation and then shedding the doctors and returning them back to private practice. And so I think we're near maximum consolidation at this point, where most physicians are employees. The practices are now owned by large corporations or hospitals. And so I see that pendulum is likely going to start swinging back at some point. And so my position, or the thing that I'm attempting to do, is to establish a regulatory environment in the nation that allows doctors that come back out into private practice to thrive. And so we want to make sure that state regulations are friendly to independently practicing physicians. We want to make sure that federal regulations are friendly to them as well. So
tell us what you think the major barriers from a regulatory standpoint are to DPC.
On the state side, it's, you know, if a physician is agreeing to provide unlimited primary care services for a fixed monthly fee, is that physician a risk-bearing entity and should they be regulated as an insurance company? That's probably the largest one at the state level. And so we have seen success now in 25 states that have passed legislation that specifically state if a doctor and a patient contract with each other for care for a flat monthly fee, the doctor doesn't become an insurance company. The doctor's not regulated by the Office of Insurance Regulation and they're exempt. And we're not saying that physician practices should not be regulated. They're heavily regulated. They're the most heavily regulated industry probably in the country. But they're regulated by the Board of Medicine. They're regulated under contract law, but they're not regulated as insurance companies. So you don't have, you know, COBRA rules, and you don't have all the other nonsense that goes along with being an insurance company. So what that means is that we still have half the states in the country that don't have that protection.
So does that mean that in those states that you can't have a DPC practice, or you have a DPC practice, but you just rest on the fact that nobody's ever actually cracked down on any DPC practice ever?
I wouldn't say that nobody's ever cracked down on it ever. You know, there definitely is some history back there where some practices have been approached and questioned whether or not they are operating an insurance company. But nothing out there to say that you cannot do it. There is no law banning this. But if you are, you know, questioned, you know, if somebody challenges it and you don't have the background, the question is whether or not you have the financial, wherewithal to withstand that challenge. You know, you get a cease and desist letter from the insurance commissioner. What do you do with that? And can you survive that? Do you have the resources to fight that? In half the states, that's no longer an issue. And so I think that at least sets a pretty strong precedent for how the rest of the country is going to go.
And so that's one. What did you find? Was the Affordable Care Act, was that helpful or in terms of DPC? Or I've heard both things for a variety of different reasons. So what are your thoughts on the Affordable Care Act and how it kind of plays in the sandbox with DPC?
Yeah, I could probably take a lot of different positions on this. I think in general, the Affordable Care Act's insurance mandate has been very challenging for DPC. The fact that if people sign up for a DPC plan, They get penalized by the federal government because they can't afford insurance, but they can't afford DPC, I think, has been a detriment to the DPC practices. But at the same time, the Affordable Care Act has raised insurance premiums so high that people have no choice but to go to DPC or not get health care. And the other, you know, the other issue is that the Affordable Care Act has raised deductibles so high that basically everybody is a cash consumer now in the current healthcare market. And so they're forced to find value, and there's nothing more valuable in the healthcare market in the country right now than DPC.
Yeah. When you recently went to, Congress to, or you recently testified in front of Congress, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I was invited to testify before the United States Senate Health Committee. That's a Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee.
Have you been asked to testify before to Congress in prior administrations, or is this something new? Or
in prior administrations, I gave briefings to Congress. So I, when Tom Price was the head of the Congressional, I believe it's the Congressional Budget Office. I think it was actually the House Budget Committee. But anyway, I gave a briefing to the staffers there. We've given private briefings to members of Congress, but this is the first formal testimony that I've been invited to give at the federal level.
So you think this administration is clearly been friendlier to DPC than the prior administration?
Absolutely, positively, there's no question about it that this administration is extremely friendly to DPC. Does that mean that they've been successful at any actionable items? No. But I mean, I can tell you that I personally have been to the White House 5 times. And, you know, we have met with senior advisors to the president. The White House just released about 115-page document called the Choice and Competition Report, which highlights federal and state changes that can help improve and choice and competition, improving quality and reducing cost. And direct primary care was a featured piece of that report. So this was signed off by the president's cabinet. So the president's cabinet formally recommended making changes to federal tax law in favor of direct primary care.
So Lee, how did it happen that why is there this party distinction here? Like I mentioned before that, and I think you and I are in the same, or maybe at least I'm in that same boat, that I don't think there's a really an ideological bent to any of this. For me, the general solution seems relatively obvious in terms of how you try to reduce the unit cost of healthcare for a vast majority of what we do, and it seems, so that doesn't seem to live on the Democrat side or the Republican side. Both Democrats and Republicans want healthcare at much cheaper than what it is right now. So why is it that there's this seeming party divide? I mean, you're describing the fact that, you know, the Democrat administration, which, I mean, the whole act was called the Affordable Care Act. Why is it that there's this divide between Democrats and Republicans in terms of how friendly they are to this type of movement?
Yeah, I don't know if it's fair to paint with that broad of a brush, because I think if you take it down to the state level, where the state really does need to solve these problems, you know, all the legislation that's been introduced at the state level has been bipartisan. You know, in some states it's been introduced by Democrats, in some states it's been introduced by Republicans, and almost every vote in every state has been bipartisan in favor of direct primary care. I think the problem is with the timing. You know, so first of all, direct primary care was included as a clause in the Affordable Care Act. There actually was an authorizing clause in the Affordable Care Act for DPC. So you could argue that the Democrats are the first ones on the federal level that supported DPC. But the problem is that DPC sort of became a relief valve for the Affordable Care Act. And as people were starting to see, as I mentioned earlier, people starting to sort of switch over to DPC, it was seen as driving people out of the exchanges, which was seen as sort of submarining the Affordable Care Act's marketplaces. And so the Obama administration IRS commissioner started laying roadblocks and saying, well, DPC is a health plan, and therefore you can't use a health savings account with it. And so they wrote opinion pieces that sort of laid landmines at the foot of the DPC practices. And, you know, DPC was sort of getting its legs right at the time when you started to see this bitter partisan fight over the Affordable Care Act. And it was seen as kind of an obstacle to that. So I think that's probably where you start to see this divide. Well, now we're starting to have the conversation about, you know, this Medicare for all or single payer healthcare system. And that is basically part of the Democrats' national platform. And, you know, DPC does not fit in with that model. I mean, it doesn't fit in at all with that model, unless the single payer is the patient, of course. So when I testified before the U.S. Senate, this was a bipartisan hearing, and I had to undergo interviews by the Republican staff and the Democrat staff. And when we actually got to the actual hearing, not a single Democrat asked me a question. I was sort of like Voldemort, the person who you wouldn't name, you know, you just didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah. You're so right. This didn't used to be this partisan, but the problem is that this tribalism has been induced by the Affordable Care Act. So you're either for the Affordable Care Act or you're against it. And then you're either totally, because it's your team that did the ACA, you're completely committed to everything that'll support the ACA and make the ACA work. And anything that's seen that, you know, is seen as making the ACA not work, or, you know, seen as perhaps, as you're saying, submarining it, you know, you have to be opposed to it. So it's unfortunate that it's become so utterly political. It would be lovely, though I'm encouraged by the fact that you say that at the state level, you know, people are still recognizing, all right, here's a problem. This is here, and here's a solution that would work. You know, I'd love it to get back to this. I'd love health policy to get back to the stage where, you know, when a patient comes in with a pneumonia, you don't think, ah, what is the Democrat approach to this? And what is the Republican approach to this pneumonia? We still have to treat, you know, we'd like to treat the problem. And I'd love it to not be so bitter and partisan as it is now. You know, now people just tune out. People will stop listening to Dr. Gross and what he's going to say about the wonderful stuff he's done. If there's any tinge of partisanship to it, it's really unfortunate.
Yeah, and that was sort of why we, you know, I don't know if you know, we did 5 shows on Sean Hannity's show, and Sean Hannity is obviously a lightning rod, and he's a firebrand. But you know, we're, you know, out in the open right now. You know, we used to be in the shadows. The DPC is kind of in the shadows. Nobody really knew about us, but now we're out in the open. And we're vulnerable. So we're vulnerable to sort of be squashed. And so what that means is that we need to run as far and as fast and spread it as far as we can, so that we're so big that they can't stop us. And we need to do that quickly. And so you do that by engaging somebody that happens to have 16 million weekly viewers and a very big, loud megaphone.
Right. On that note, so we'll link to the your recent op-ed in the Washington Examiner that Anish mentioned, which is really fantastic. And to me, it was it really made DPC realistic. I mean, the way you laid out, it's not a big editorial, but it's there. All of a sudden, you can see how this could work. Right, you make it very, very concrete in how it could work in solving this cost crisis. But I want to ask you another question is that we don't talk about too much, is that if DPC will decrease costs, you know, in a major way, it will also decrease the income of many primary care physicians who decide to adopt it. I mean, and I know that, you know, personally, by my own personal experience. When I was working in the system and, you know, collecting money from third parties, I made beaucoup dollars. And when I, in the DPC model, it's much more difficult. And I'm not complaining, but it's the reality. To what extent you see that physicians themselves are going to be, trying to either torpedo it or push back or whatnot? Or will there be a divide of physicians who lack the comfort and the safety and the security of the third-party paycheck versus those who will be willing to push and embrace the DPC model?
Yeah, so I obviously have a different or slightly different perspective on that because I've been at it a little bit longer than most, and I would say that my income from my DPC practice now rivals anything I made in a fee-for-service practice. So
I think it's important to say that. You're right. But certainly there'd be a spectrum of income on the, you know, which will be determined by the ability of the doctor to provide value to patients, right? And those who can do it well and who, you know, will make, you know, a very good income, you know, hopefully. And then those who cannot will not. As opposed to getting a paycheck from the third-party payer, it makes no difference to the third-party payer if you're a good doctor or a bad doctor, right? So long as the CPT code is the same.
And so from the perspective of the third-party payer, when you're in a system that basically every, you know, a nurse practitioner and a physician assistant and a physician basically all have equal value because, you know, you all are, all your services are undervalued and, you know, all you do is refer out to specialists anyway because you don't have any time, then, you know, the physician is expendable in that system. So you might make a lot of money, but you're replaceable. You're just a cog in the wheel. Whereas in the DPC model, what it truly does is, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, letting nurse practitioners practice to the full scope of their training. But I would argue that the DPC practice model allows physicians to practice to the full scope of their training. And it allows doctors to actually be doctors. And so the downstream potential savings in doing primary care better are astronomical in terms of the potential savings for the entire system. So my expectation is that as those dollars are realized, that, you know, especially with these employer arrangements, the potential for shared savings arrangements and so forth really can potentially compensate the primary care doctor much better.
But this gets back to what the problem Michelle is raising. Gets back to what I initially brought up was that you're in a little bit of a catch-22 where we don't have a lot of options for even specialists to be able to set up shop on their own because healthcare is such a tightly regulated market, right? Michelle is an interventional cardiologist. Michelle could, you know, do all kinds of stuff at much, much, much lower cost than the hospital in a lab with a C-arm and, you know, his own little space, but he can't do it. He's restricted from doing, he's not allowed to do it. So I think part of the issue in terms of the barriers relate to the fact that there isn't the milieu, certainly that's currently exists. There isn't a milieu that exists for specialists, certainly, to be able to do this in a way that would really massively scale the savings here. You know, you're talking about savings in primary care, which is totally true. You know, the downstream revenue that you save when you have good primary care is massive. You don't consult 25 people. You have time to spend, and all that is totally true. But, you know, here you have Medicare paying $19,000 for an atrial flutter ablation. Commercial payers probably pay, I don't know, 1.5, maybe 2 times that, right, for a 23-hour stay. So the amount of money that's moving through these systems is huge. And unfortunately, the hospitals have a monopoly because of certificate of need laws, a variety of other regulations that don't allow, you know, us as physicians to kind of make full use of our skills at cost. So
if I could piggyback on top of that and say, okay, so what did the physician that actually put in the pacemaker get paid? I would probably $1,000 maybe?
I don't know. This was an ablation, but yeah, I'm sure the professional fee is like, you know, $500, something crazy small.
It's crazy small, but if you consider that entire hospitalization doesn't exist if it's not for that one physician to provide that one service,
right?
You generated $200,000 in charges on the back of one human being that got paid $500 to do that.
Right.
That is a tremendous amount of waste. That is a tremendous amount of third-party administrator nonsense that just drives up the cost of healthcare and adds no value.
Right.
So, Lee, I'm going to challenge here Anisha's pessimism by using repeating the phrase that you used just a minute ago of saying that in DPC, you know, doctors can be doctors, right? It's a system that lets doctors be doctors, which means that in my mind, it's really most there's an income risk when you go the direct route, But most doctors who have gone, who have pioneered, and who will continue to pioneer, despite the challenges on paper, we know what the challenges are on paper, but people who do it for ethical reasons, because they want to be doctors. And when you're in the system, you're really not a doctor. You're a subcontractor, essentially, to the insurance company or to the government. And so I think, you know, with doctors willing to take a risk, and doing it for ethical reasons and for sanity reason, because, you know, you're then in control of your professional life, is going to happen. You know, it may not be very rapid. It's maybe harder for specialists, but specialists will do it no matter what. And we'll just keep chipping away at the edges and wherever we can move in that direction. But before we let you go, I know you've been generous with your time, Lee. Tell us about the Docs for Patient Care Foundation that you're leading, because I think it's also related to what I'm just talking about.
Well, first of all, I would have to absolutely agree with everything you just said in terms of the ethics of the practice of medicine, which will largely drive, you know, this movement. So you're 100% correct there. Docs for Patient Care is a nonprofit foundation. It's a tax-deductible organization. You know, one of the things that we found in working in health policy is that there were never any doctors at the table. And in the run-up to the Affordable Care Act, everyone kept saying, you know, where are the doctors? Where are the doctors? And when the American Medical Association endorsed the Affordable Care Act without getting anything that the physicians needed in exchange, they said, well, where are our representation? And so the Docs for Patient Care Foundation sort of was born out of that lack of physician leadership, of practicing physicians. Sort of felt like we were kind of lost. And we want practicing physicians, people that actually see patients for a living, see, you know, a person that holds a dying patient's hand or that is there, you know, with a newborn, to be involved in the health policy conversations. And so we have physicians in all walks of life and all practices as members of our board that help craft and work with policymakers on health policy development. So we work at state level, we work at federal level, we put on educational conferences. So we just put on a conference in Orlando, Florida, where we brought in 380 physicians from 40 states to teach them how to set up direct primary care practices. We receive grants to put those on, so we actually don't charge physicians to attend those conferences. And so we'll be putting on another conference. This is our third conference. So we have, between our three conferences, had approximately 750 physicians that have come through to learn how to establish direct primary care practice in the last 3 years.
Lee, it's been terrific. Where can people follow you? I know you're on Twitter, and do you have a blog you want to tell us?
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Lee Gross. And you can check out our practice's website. That's epiphanyhealth.org, epiphanyhealth.org. And check out the Docs for Patient Care Foundation website. That's D4PCFoundation.org.
Okay, we'll have all that on the show notes.
Last question, Lee. Are you hiring cardiologists?
No, but we are definitely looking for primary care physicians in Southwest Florida.
Actually, that's a very important question, because I foresee that in the future, that's exactly what will happen. That as the direct primary care movement will grow, then the primary care physician will be at the top of the pecking order, which is the way it should be, and it should have been all along. And the specialists will be, you know, serving a very good primary care doctor. And so I think, you know, Anish may be facetious here, but it's I think it would be a great thing when we see that happening, and it will happen.
I'm looking forward to the day.
Okay.
Thanks, gentlemen. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Akkad and Coca Report. Subscribe for free on iTunes or Stitcher at akkadandcoca.com, where you'll find detailed show notes, our blog, and more. akkadandcoca.com.